I'd like to welcome you to the next in our series of Global Health Perspectives podcasts. My name is Derek Yach. I'm the president of the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. And we've been carrying out these podcasts with colleagues around the world involved in different aspects of tobacco control, harm reduction, starting during the beginning of the pandemic and continuing, hopefully, until it ends before too long. Today, I have the real pleasure to have Harry Shapiro with me. Harry is the editor of the Global State of Tobacco Harm Reduction, the second time they've released this very important report. And before I get going, Harry, it would be great for you maybe just to tell us a little bit about your journey from the broad area of harm reduction and what got you excited and interested about stepping into the tobacco harm reduction area for this report.
Yes, thank you, Derek, and thank you for the invitation. I mean, I've been working in the world of illegal drugs since the late 70s, working for UK NGOs in information communications and policy work. And as often sadly happens with drug charities these days, charities of all sorts, that all came to an end in 2015. Much of my time, though, had been spent promoting and lecturing and doing a lot of media work around drug and HIV harm reduction, which was all about safer sex. It was all about needle exchange, opiate substitute treatment, all the things really to essentially keep people alive while they consider, particularly in the drugs arena, considering, you know, what their futures might be. And my kind of mantra was about that is you can't recover if you're dead. And so therefore it was very important that we promoted that idea of drug harm reduction. Much to the consternation of a lot of, you know, medical agencies and politicians, and I have to say the WHO in the early days, they did eventually come round. So I was kind of well sort of steeped in the kind of ethos and principles of harm reduction. And then when the last iteration of my work in the drugs field came to an end in 2015, although I have actually kept that going in a much smaller way with a small information website called DrugWise, which kind of keeps that whole principle of going of drug information, which is topical, non-judgmental and evidence-based. That was like the three guiding principles, really. And I think the same pretty much applies to tobacco harm reduction as well. But what happened was that I was invited by two colleagues who I knew very well from the drugs world, Professor Jerry Stimson and Paddy Costell, who invited me to come and be the rapporteur for the Global Forum on Nicotine conference in Warsaw in 2015 and 2016. And then in 2017, they asked me to kind of write a blog for nicotine science and policy. And that eventually morphed into this idea of the global state of tobacco harm reduction. So you could say I was groomed over a period of time to come over to tobacco harm reduction. And I think because Paddy and Jerry kind of were already there and they'd already realised that there was a very good read across from tobacco, from drug harm reduction, which in its earliest days, and HIV, was really a bottom-up community public health initiative. It wasn't driven by public health officials or politicians or governments. It was communities trying to look after themselves and their friends and their peers. And this was very much the genesis of tobacco harm reduction in the very early days. It was a community-led initiative. So all of that, it kind of was a very easy transition for me kind of been there ever since.
Yeah, I think the first report that you put out certainly laid out the size of the need as well as some of the progress or not progress on the legislative side. But it'd be good if you could explain what you see as some of the major findings of the second report that you've released literally in the last weeks. Particularly striking to me is the very good data that you've now got on the growth of the user base, that it's actually a very substantial user base, as well as how the evidence is hardening in favor of benefits. So maybe you could speak to those two things to start with in the report.
Yeah. Well, we have the report itself is the kind of product of a lot of team work. I mean, I was the lead author and editor, but there was a lot of hard work went on, especially on the data collection side. And we have a very good head of data who's very good at doing the analysis that you need to draw out information, which is not that easy to come by, either because it's kind of, commercially sensitive, so it's kind of locked up in company reports, or it's the product of or it's the crown jewels of market analysis firms who don't readily give that kind of information away for free. Although I have to say some of them were very helpful in this respect in terms of helping us gather data. So I think it was quite a complicated process, and I put my hand up straight away and say, I am not a numbers person. I do words rather than figures. But the report itself, if people go to the report, they will find a very detailed appendix which will enlighten them as to exactly how we got to a point where we can say we have something approaching 100 million users of safer nicotine products, which covers not just the vaping products or e-cigarettes, which is a term we're trying to kind of move away from because it is a little bit misleading, really, because a number of those devices don't even look like cigarettes. And of course, it also makes them aligned too closely with traditional cigarettes.
So just to explain to people, of the 100 million, how does that break down in terms of sort of the broad categories of e-cigarettes, heated?
Yeah, sure. So very roughly 68 million, 70 odd million people using vaping products, around 20 million people using heated tobacco products, and around 10 million people using snus, oral tobacco product. So that's pretty much where it kind of breaks down and is in fact higher than some of the market S projections of where we would be by 2021. I mean, the highest figure I can remember seeing was something in the region of 50 million. Well, on our calculation, we'd probably double that. So that's actually extremely encouraging. Although it has to be set against, of course, the actual number of smokers that there still are. And that figure is something in the region of 1.1 billion. So we are a long way from any kind of tipping point.
But, I always remind people that, when you look at the transformation of the internal combustion engine, you had to start with 1, 2, 3, 10,000, 50,000. So you've got to start somewhere, and 100 million is not starting somewhere. It's suggesting there's a pretty large group of consumers demanding, enjoying. What proportion of them, do you have any sense, are dual users?
That I couldn't tell you. I'm not sure. It may be buried. We could probably find the answer to that somewhere, but it's not. It's not a figure that readily comes to mind. I have to admit.
I said that the other thing that strikes me is that over the last year, we've had a lot of interesting stuff coming out of the FDA, UK, Cochrane. So would you say that the evidence on the benefit side is getting stronger compared to the report 2 years ago?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think the evidence that is certainly consistent. We've got more studies now showing, for example, that people using e-cigarettes to move away from smoking cigarettes is more effective than people who've been using nicotine replacement therapy. We've got, probably most significantly, we've got the FDA now allowing the promotion of heated tobacco product and snus as being healthier than using cigarettes. And the important point about that, I think, is that they based their findings and their approval on industry science. An awful lot of industry science, a staggering amount of data was provided to the FDA for that. Now, the narrative, the external narrative on all of this so far has been you can't trust what the industry says, which is, you know, one of the major obstacles to faster progress, of course. But clearly the FDA have taken a different line. I mean, they're saying, you know, it all has to be monitored and we have to keep our eye on everything, and that's absolutely fine. But that's an important step forward, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly, and I think it's daunting for people to go to the FDA website and see there's a million pages plus of detailed data and science and research that if industry gets it wrong or deliberately falsifies, they are in deep legal trouble. So the consequences of actually not putting out the facts the way they are huge for the industry, which makes it, again, I think, more likely than not that this is real stuff.
Yes. I mean, I think in the past, and I'm not a tobacco smoking historian, but I'm guessing that the industry in past days was able to kind of, you know, fudge the issue quite well and did not come under the kind of public and scientific scrutiny that it would be nowadays. I think, although the peer review processes leave something to be desired from what I understand, I think it's a lot stronger now in terms of what you can and can't get away with from a methodological point of view when presenting evidence like this.
Yeah. So one of the other things in the report is you talk a lot about the misperception of risk and how we're seeing consumers, a high proportion, believe that nicotine is the cause of cancer or causes all of these harms. And the Ivali outbreak of last year, alleged Ivali outbreak, you also describe. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about what are you seeing on the landscape of this misperception of risk? Is it getting better or worse since the first report, or are you just able to document what's going on better?
Well, unfortunately, I think set against, you know, the good news of a greater acceptance of the science in some quarters and the rise in the number of users, I think the environment generally has become more toxic. Now, whether that's true because the people who are against tobacco harm reduction and safer nicotine products feel they are being kind of moved to the wrong side of history and are kind of, you know, digging in and fighting back, I'm not entirely sure. But there's no doubt that from the EU, from the WHO, from the various campaigning NGOs that are Western-based in the USA and in Europe, they're certainly kind of turning up the mood music, really, I suppose, to keep on with the narrative that this is all, you know, a big conspiracy by big tobacco to get kids hooked on smoking again through the use of e-cigarettes and Juul and all the rest of it. So I think that has got worse, and the tragedy of it getting worse is that smokers and even health professionals, which is even scarier, really, you know, believe that nicotine is the culprit here. And I think what's interesting, I think the goalposts have been shifted, because it used to be when I was writing that first report in 2018, it was all about, this is a plot to get young people to smoke. It was a gateway to smoking. Well, the figures, for example, from the US show quite clearly that smoking amongst young people has been in fairly rapid decline for some years now. While experimentation with e-cigarettes, vaping products has gone up. And I think the goalposts have shifted now, and that people keep now talking much more about nicotine as they talk about cigarettes and smoking. So I think they've realised they've probably lost that, they've lost ground on that one. So they're now shifting to say, well, they just want to get kids addicted to nicotine and all of that. So not particularly promising from that point of view, but it's something we just have to keep pushing back against as much as possible.
Yeah, and I think that's very clear, both in the Bloomberg-funded campaign-related issues, as well as in the FDA's own education programs aimed at kids in the US. It's very much focused on nicotine is the big bogeyman. It's going to addict you. It's going to fry your brain. It's going to have these terrible consequences, without ever considering the alternative on the combustible side. Or frankly, what happens when you take them both off the market and you're left with a rising level of marijuana, opioid, and alcohol use? I think what the report also is exceptional this time round in highlighting is you really do follow the money in terms of how big philanthropy feeds its way through NGOs and goes global into media. And I think shining that light make people realize that things are not just appearing randomly in stories. That must have been quite an effort to actually get out. And I imagine you had to check with the lawyers that everything there is going to be safe and secure for your own benefit.
Well, yeah. I mean, everything that is there is in financial accounts and reports. I mean, it's actually very hard to... I mean, a lot of it is hidden, and a lot of one of the criticisms of some of the foundations is that it is actually very hard to work out how they come to their decisions and how money is actually spent. But it's pretty clear, for example, that that if you get some organisations whose all their front of house activity seems to be anti-tobacco harm reduction in one way, shape or form, and they're receiving millions of dollars from philanthropic organisations, then you don't need to be a kind of genius to work out that where most of that money is going. And some things are very blatant. And, you know, Bloomberg was proud to announce, you know, that the campaign for tobacco-free kids was going to administer a $160 million grant in order to promote the idea that they should ban all flavoured nicotine liquid. And some of this is very public. Yes, there was clearly an element of investigative journalism going on there. But once you actually looked at the data, it wasn't that difficult to kind of sort of join the dots, really. I think the important point to make here is that in the first report, because it was the first report of its kind, we were quite keen to kind of set out a whole landscape of how we got to where we are today. So there was quite a lot of backstory about e-cig development, about the genesis of international tobacco control and all of that kind of stuff. Well, we felt we didn't need to do that again. I mean, the report was already up there from 2018. People could always refer back to it. And we refer people back to that report in the latest one. But given the fact that, like I say, the environment had grown more toxic, we did feel that we kind of needed to be a little bit more assertive, maybe, than we were last time, and actually call out some of this bad science and misinformation, and let other people, you know, make their own judgments. And if they think they've got it wrong, well, show us how we've got it wrong. Demonstrate to us how it's not true.
No, I think so. Just one or two last things. But I do think that the section in the first report and some of it repeated here with new stuff on the intellectual property issues within the e-cigarette era, the patents and their importance is a very important topic that WHO has never addressed. In fact, in the Framework Convention, the term intellectual property doesn't appear once, which signals that there wasn't an internal view that there'd be innovation, technology change, industrial improvement that we'd have to look at. And I just wonder for the next report whether this is going to become quite an issue, because I actually have a sense that the intellectual property issues across the major domains of harm reduction are going to be very important to tackle to make sure that low-middle-income countries are not going to be blocked from innovation and introducing products because the patents are held by companies that are either not willing or not willing to go into the market. Basically, using the identical argument that we saw at the HIV/AIDS drug development program, where the whole thing in the end became one of intellectual property rights and how you find a formula to ensure that the lives of people in developing countries were valued similarly to those in developed countries, therefore the technologies should be available. And I think that's going to be a very important issue. I'd love your thoughts on that.
I think the difference is, I think, that at the moment the battle is still on from the WHO, from organisations like the Union, who are a Bloomberg grantee, to push countries to ban things. And what they're saying to them is that they're saying you haven't got the infrastructure or the health systems or the expertise to come to your own decisions about all these new products. The simplest thing for you to do is just ban everything. And then if the science changes, then, maybe you might consider controlling them as tobacco products. But in the meantime, just ban everything. Now, I'm not aware that there was that level of struggle around HIV because people weren't trying to ban condoms or things. Well, maybe they were in some countries.
Yeah, and remember that they were saying that these drugs are very expensive to deal with in your primary care clinics. They're going to be very complicated. And so, I'm from South Africa. Look at the arguments they used to keep the drugs out of the South African market for many years. It led to many people dying.
Yeah.
They were not completely dissimilar.
No,
but
there was a moral argument, wasn't there,
about
South Africa didn't want Western big pharma intervention in, didn't even think that HIV was caused by unsafe sexual practices and all the rest of it. It's a kind of turning it on its head a bit because there you had big pharma was like the bogey thing. Now you've got big tobacco. It will be interesting to see how it plays out. My hope would be that we get to a point where we can have arguments over intellectual property, over the ability for companies to provide products rather than the products being legislated out of existence, so we never get to the point of having those arguments.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, I think that, from what I sort of hear from a wide range of companies, unlike in the pharma era early on, there's a huge intent to get the technology out to how it can have the biggest impact. I mean, one classic example is you highlighted how the FDA has given this approval on the exposure and risk reduction of snus. We know that if a snus-like product adapted to the Indian market displaced the oral tobacco on the Indian market, we could get rid of a lot of oral cancer. And how you do that must be wrapped up in patents, the government decisions, and so on. But theoretically, there's nothing stopping that happening.
No.
They're practical issues.
That's right. No, and also, but of course, one also has to be aware that, China's got the biggest tobacco industry in the world with a seat round the Conference of the Parties table.
Yeah.
India's got the second largest tobacco industry in the world. So generally, of course, the sort of geopolitical economic tensions there must be between economics and health will probably dictate how these go. Of course, if the big tobacco companies in Southeast Asia can embrace these products, then that would be a significant step forward against, the desire of the health ministries to stick together and be part of the WHO club, if I can put it like that.
And I think if we think of where we are today in China, as you say, 40-something% of worldwide cigarette production by the Chinese state monopoly. But just in the last few weeks, Smur, the e-cigarette company out of Shenzhen, announced that it's now got the first e-cigarette billionaire in China, and they are the largest producer of e-cigarette components and parts in the world. I can't believe that they would exist without some support of the Chinese state monopoly, who may very well be looking at how long-term that is going to be the road for them. And if they'd make that decision, of course, I think it's a huge step forward. But let me just end off with one last question, Harry. If you were to look to 2022, what would be some of the maybe one or two of the headlines you hope you'll be writing about in 2022?
What a very good question. One which has been much on my mind since I put the last full stop on the current report. I would hope that, in a sense, I'm not necessarily expecting, you know, a great huge turnaround and an embracement of all what we've been talking about, but at least the brakes would be on this drive towards over-regulation and banning everything, that some of the governments would begin to start asking the right questions of the WHO, would begin to interrogate the evidence and not just simply take everything. It's a kind of get out of jail free card. It's like the WHO is saying to a lot of LMIC regions, you know, we've got this covered, you know, just kind of do this and you don't have to worry about it because it's all too difficult. And the health ministries, many of these countries have got far bigger problems to worry about in terms of infectious disease control and malaria and all the rest of it. Whereas, you know, the legislation is being handed to them on a plate. Now, I notice in the Philippines, there's been political disputes about local NGOs taking foreign money to promote anti-tobacco harm reduction activity. It could be that there's a kickback against what I've called kind of colonialism, really, in the report, about accepting huge sums of money from foreign powers and all the rest of it. So it's going to be a very interesting stew and mix between now. We've got the EU TPD being reviewed next year. We've got COP9 next November, I assume, won't be virtual. They'll probably actually be in a meeting room. Now, the direction of travel at the moment is for policies to become more hardened. There's no doubt about it. All the mood music is towards that. I'm hoping that that isn't realised, that there will be some element of pushback, that the science will become more accepted. Now, what one always looks for here in some way is some kind of tipping point, something that begins to tip the balance. I'm not quite sure what that would be, but it'd be lovely to be able to announce that tipping point when we do the next report.
Yeah, no, and I think that's fair. And hopefully it'll be one of these bigger low-middle-income countries making the shift because they see it's good both for their long-term health interests as well as maybe their commercial interests. Well, Harry, let me say thank you again, and just fantastic. And I really hope that people really study the report carefully. It's available in several languages. We will have all the links on it. And for more from us, please contact us at podcast@smokefreeworld.org. As Harry reminded us, we are in the midst of a pandemic that is probably going to get worse before it gets better, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. So keep using your masks. Make sure you physically distance. Take care and make sure you're fully vaccinated. And thank you again, Harry.
Thank you.